core of an effective therapy is not to make something new, but to undo what is wrong. You don't have to worry about what are we supposed to do. The whole emphasis is not to do the ignorant, not to continue with your ignorance. When the emphasis is on not to continue with your ignorance, then the fulcrum of effectiveness rests on what you actually do. And the control for and the responsibility for your actions, what you actually do, can be managed. Notice the emphasis. There's an ethical emphasis here. Is distinct from a moral emphasis. The moral emphasis is a mirage. The ethical emphasis is a miracle. If you know that it's what you do that is actually the effective cutting edge, that's why I like the hand, is the cutting edge of the mind. If what you actually do in your life is the effective area, then you do what is right, not on the basis of an external sense, but on the basis of an internal sense. So that no matter what happens to you, no matter what's going on in your life, which you really don't have control over very, very frequently, but you do always have control over your response to it, how you take it, what you do in view of this situation. And as you put the emphasis then, ethically, on what you do, your response to it, you shift the whole basis back into this energy cycle, back into this flow. You make that second stage, instead of a place of contention, you make of it an openness whose frame of reference is guaranteed by the integrity of what you do. And that integrity melds with that energy flow so that as the energy flow keeps happening, more and more the external situation, because it is always responsive to the Tao, as the Chinese would say, clears up. It doesn't clear up because you forced it to clear up. It clears up because you participated in the real energy flow. And one of the signs is that it becomes easier and easier to conduct yourself with integrity. Now, it's a kind of a false viewpoint that it's very difficult to be a saint. Actually, on that kind of a level, it's extremely effortless to be a saint. Is no effort whatsoever. To be a bodhisattva is no effort whatsoever. It's a projection of the egotistical standpoint. One would say, well, that's got to be more and more difficult, and I can't make it. That's too hard. I can live on this level. I can do what's right on Sundays, or I can do what's right on Friday night, but I don't know about Wednesday morning. I got to go to work, man. See, it's like that. Whereas the effectiveness of what you do, the rightness of the effectiveness is its continuousness, its continuity. That's like that key, that's like that secret that's in there. And as you do that, it transforms the world to be consonant with what you are doing. The reality of the world is such that it responds to this kind of a yoga. Actually responds to it. You can pick it up. The mythological presentation of this is like Hiawatha needing something and goes to the trees and says, give me of this, O trees. Or goes to an animal and says, oh, give me of this. Can talk to nature. Another high medieval image of this is St. Francis preaching to the birds. And when he could preach to the birds, the wolf of Gubbio was no longer a threat to him. no longer a vicious animal polarized to him, but was a companion along the way, to such an extent that he began to write a visionary poetry of saying, brother, sun, sister, moon. There's nothing in the cosmos that's not in the family of the ecology of that energy. And at that point, just to give you a little footnote, St. Francis was no longer just a Christian. He transcended even that large-scale structure. And just to follow that for a second, he stopped being in Italy and he went to the archetypal center. He went to Egypt. He went to Alexandria. And when he got there, of course, they grabbed him, you know, Christian monk, rabble-rouser, and they took him to authority after authority, and finally was brought before the Grand Caliph. And the Caliph listened to St. Francis. And he said, this is a man of Allah. And they let him go. Not only let him go, but returned him safely to Italy. There was no danger to him whatsoever. Because he could be understood at a very refined, high level. This is a man of God. It doesn't matter what he calls himself. This is a man of God. We don't interfere with him because it was understood, you see. What I'm giving to you is not something new. It's as old as the hills. It is traditional human wisdom, and it's recognizable the world round at any time that human beings have matured. Chinese, Islamic, Jewish, Christian, probably even Martian, I don't know, but probably even Martian. So that this energy cycle goes with the eight trigrams, so that the energy cycle is the punctuation, it's the interval, it's the unspoken quality that gives articulation to the cycle of the eight trigrams. So that the eight trigrams and their amplified ring of 64 hexagrams, the 64 hexagrams change. How do they change? They change in terms of the modulations of the five-phase energy cycle. So that, for instance, a mathematician of the quality of Leibniz was able to understand when he saw the 64 hexagrams. He saw them in a translation in Amsterdam. Some of the I Ching was translated into Latin, and Leibniz, even at 21, was a genius. Could read Latin as well as his native German, and had the insight to be able to understand that using this binary system and using some kind of an energy flow, that the 64 hexagrams of the I Ching, when translated into mathematical form, showed a complementary process, that as one half of the I Ching winds down, the other half revs up. And that as you finally approach the hexagram of three unbroken lines, you at the same time on the other side of the circle have the hexagram of the six broken lines. So that the sequence of the 64 hexagrams of the I Ching maintains a constant ratio of unity at any transverse diameter. Any diameter of the ring of the 64 hexagrams always has the same ratio. Ratio. It's Latin for reason. So that the I Ching, in its expressive symbolic form, maintains a self-consistent internal balance at all times. Leibniz's treatise was translated into English about 10 years ago and published by the University of Hawaii Press, entitled The Natural Theology of the Chinese. Most of Leibniz has never been translated because it's still too dangerous for the powers that be. Leibniz was the great inheritor of all the occult traditions of the West. Yeah, Leibniz, the mathematician, the philosopher. He was the head of the Rosicrucian order in his day. He was the man. He was the private tutor in the family, the German family, who became the kings of England. You think this is small potatoes? Only George couldn't stand the fact that the guy knew and that he wasn't the source of power, right? I'm the king. So he left Leibniz in Germany with his wife, Sophie, and their daughters and so forth. And all of Leibniz's manuscripts, there are about 200 or 300 of them, still are on shelves of the Royal Library there, untranslated, unpublished, and unlooked at, even 300 years later. Because the co-optive power structures of Western history are all based upon a kind of false lineage. Enough of that. Dichi Suzuki, in translating Lao Tzu, gives us a basic key to open up the symbolic vision of the I Ching. And the 42nd chapter gives us the five-phase energy cycle. Then in the 67th chapter of the Tao Te Ching, here's how it reads in English translation. This again is about 1987, Da Liu. The whole world says that I am vast and resemble nothing. It is because I resemble nothing that I am able to be vast. If I resembled anything, I would long before now have become small. Now I constantly have three treasures which I hold and cherish. The first is known as compassion. The second is known as frugality. The third is known as not daring to take the lead in the empire. It is very Chinese, very esoteric. Being compassionate, I am able to be courageous. Being frugal, I am able to be generous. Not daring to take the lead in the empire, I am able to be lord over the complete vessel, the Tao. Now to forsake my compassion for courage, to forsake my frugality for generosity, to forsake my position in the rear for the lead is a sure end in death. Notice how through compassion I can triumph in war and be impregnable in peace. When heaven sets up something, it keeps it, as it were, behind ramparts of compassion. That's very profound wisdom. This translation, incidentally, is one that you probably can get down in Chinatown. And this is very interesting. This translation of the Tao Te Ching is a monumental translation. All of the other translations that we had of the Tao Te Ching were all based on medieval Chinese manuscripts. The earliest manuscript that we had, and the reason that we have it, was engraved in stone during the Tang Dynasty. When Tai Tsung set up the Tang Dynasty, he made sure that basic records of Chinese civilization would last and had them engraved on stone and placed in various parts of the empire. Tai Tsung was really somebody. He did it right. And so the earliest text of the Tao Te Ching came from about the 700s. Now, we had fragments of the Tao Te Ching from a couple hundred years later, but just fragments. But in 1983, in the People's Republic of China, they opened up one of the royal tombs outside of what is today Xi'an, China. In ancient times, it was the capital of China, Chang'an. It was the Tai Tsung's capital in the Tang Dynasty, and it was the capital of Han China 1,000 years or so before that. One of the royal tombs had two texts of the Tao Te Ching engraved on tablets put in the tomb, which dated from before the Han Dynasty, dated from the times of Chuang Tzu, about 250 BC. So that this is a translation from the original Tao Te Ching, 1,000 years before the earliest text that we had ever up until that time. And incidentally, in here, because of the text being so ancient, we had a chance for the first time, and all this is done just in the last couple of years, to see the original sequence of the Tao Te Ching. And incidentally, the sequence has been inverted. It was inverted in later Chinese dynastic history, so that the second part of the Tao Te Ching is about the Te. The first part is about Tao, the second part about Te. In the original, the Te came first. Te means virtue. But it doesn't mean virtue like goody-goody. It means virtue as the energy that makes things happen. Te is power. It's the only real power there is. It's the power of how the real manifests. And any manifestation that doesn't have the real isn't. For instance, it's just like in a cartoon version, a real powerful yogi can insist on reality, and anything which is imaginary will not exist. This is like in the myth that when the Godhead wakes up, all of the appearances disappear. Where do they disappear to? They disappear. The way I was taught was, that's it. The Te is this quality that makes it possible. It is, in fact, the energy of this whole cycle coming to its fullness, coming to the 10,000 things, coming to infinity. The Te is the human capacity raised to its universal, to where it can flow back into the Tao, so that the original Tao Te Ching was originally the Te Tao Ching. Not Tao Te Ching, Te Tao Ching. So the Te is first. And I've given the original order of the Tao Te Ching from this. Some of the chapters have been transposed, and if you like, you can. We have a copy machine, and you can copy for yourself. And you can take any translation of the Tao Te Ching now and put it into its proper order. And when you read it in its proper order, it has a flow sequence that's quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. The beginning of the second part is now seen as the beginning of the whole manuscript. The beginning of the second part begins with chapter 38, what is now chapter 38. So at the very beginning of the Tao Te Ching is chapter 38, which begins with a discussion of Te, of virtue. Every other word, every other character is Te. It's like every other character was Tao. But in the Tao, every other character was like beginning with one. So it was all of the odd. One, three, five, and so forth. With the Te, every other word on the even series is with Te. So that there's an esoteric teaching here which has to be brought out orally. When you talk about power of reality, you have to talk about it from a basis of tranquility, evenness. It moves like that. So that power always moves with this kind of tandem quality. I always hold my fingers like a tuning fork, because that's the way I was taught. That it moves like that. It's just like in the DNA sequence. The sequence would not work with life energy if it weren't balanced. If you don't have the pairs of the acids together, nothing would happen. It's the flow through the pairs that makes the energy, makes the dynamic. But it doesn't flow through the pairs because of a polarity. That's a misunderstanding. It flows through them because of a harmony. Life energy flows because of a harmony, not because it's a tension between opposites. There's a fundamental difference. The shape of human personality that comes out of the forms carved out of tension is the ego. The ego is based on conflict. It defines itself on conflict. But the deep self defines itself on harmonious wholeness. It's quite different. And a human personality, instead of being egotistical, if it's formed on wholeness, is open, has an openness. Openness. It's like the saying used to be, when two Zen masters meet, it's like two open doors facing each other. There's no place to put doorknobs or locks. There's no place for it. It doesn't exist. So that the mature, wholesome personality is open, as in universally open. Is quite a different experience. They are whatever the reality of the situation is happening. That's what they are. If the reality is you got to dig the ground to get the seeds in, there's no idea that you're being reduced to poverty. You till the ground and put the seeds in. That is what is happening. So chapter 38, here's how it reads. That the first word is the word for discussion. Not just one person talking, monologue, but for discussion. What we would call dialogue. First character means dialogue. Second character means te, virtue, power. Third character is superior, meaning the completest. Not the highest, but meaning the completest, superior in that sense. Superior in the sense that this is the bullseye. And the fourth character is again te, virtue. The fifth character is bu. Bu is a syllable which means not. He translates it as un. And the sixth character again te. So unvirtue, and then he uses two characters together that are like an argument statement, meaning therefore. And then there's the word for has. You is like the very opposite of not. It has. And then the character for te, virtue. So it has a very interesting kind of a pretzel syntax. Let's see what the translation is here. A discussion of virtue, superior virtue, unvirtue, therefore it has virtue. Now to the egotistical, linear, Western way, this is inscrutable talk. And indeed the Chinese had the reputation of being inscrutable. Is not inscrutable at all. It's no more inscrutable than Heraclitus, who was also called inscrutable. No more inscrutable than Roger Bacon, also called inscrutable. In other words, there's a whole mental realization process based on wholeness and not on identity, which has been considered junk. So that the Western historical personality has been habituated only to form in one particular logical sequence presentation of it. And you can see some of the values that escape being recognized in this comportment. One of the traditional values is the importance of a woman, not just the feminine. That's a stupid way to talk about it. The feminine, reducing woman to an idea. In Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, she brings out the Tao Te of the human relationships when the feminine sensibility is operating unencumbered by the habitual linear consciousness. And because in 1927, when it first came out, it was such a new kind of a writing that people called it stream of consciousness writing. She's tapped the subconscious, is what they meant. Not stream of conscious, they meant to say subconscious. She's writing from the subconscious. But the fact is, she isn't writing from the subconscious at all. She's writing from consciousness based on wholeness rather than consciousness channeled into identities. I'd hope to be able to get to it, but I'll have to put most of it off till next week. But let me just bring this example. I hope that you're reading into the lighthouse. This is just an example. This is from the first section, The Window. This is from page 158 through 160. And we'll end with this today. Try and get your copy and try and read in it. "Andrew," she said, "hold your plate lower, or I shall spill it." The bœuf en daube was a perfect triumph. Here, she felt, putting the spoon down, was the still space that lies about the heart of things, where one could move or rest, could wait now, they were all helped, listening. Could then, like a hawk, which lapses suddenly from its high station, flaunt and sink on laughter easily, resting her whole weight upon what at the other end of the table her husband was saying about the square root of 1,253. That was the number, it seemed, on his watch. Can you see in that little paragraph how easily Virginia Woolf, English lady writing in 1927 in London, taps that wholeness of the Tao? She's not imitating the Chinese at all. She's writing from her own self, her own deep self. Read into it, friends. Get your own copy. And bring your talisman. Thank you.